This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The nation is divided. Left, right, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, blue state, red state. It often feels like two Americas, but political experts and demographers who study the fault lines between us say it's more complicated than that. The Great Divide is also influenced by where we live. Add to all those other dividing lines the urban-rural split. Depending upon where we live, we experience the world differently and are influenced by those around us. Place can matter more than mere politics in understanding our differences, and that is particularly apparent here in North Carolina. So, this hour we take a closer look at the influence of place on politics with Dante Cheney and Dr. Michael Bitzer. Dante Cheney is a journalist in residence at George Washington University in Washington and director of the American Communities Project, a collaboration among the Wall Street Journal, PBS NewsHour, and WNYC Radio, which studies politics, socioeconomics, and culture. He also writes for NBC News and The Wall Street Journal. He joins us by phone from Washington. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on.
And, of course, our old friend Dr. Michael Bitzer is provost of and professor of political science at Catawba College in Salisbury. Welcome back to the show.
My pleasure.
Dante, in 2010, you wrote a book called Our Patchwork Nation. You've since gone on to become director of the American Communities Project. Is that a natural progression? Did one grow out of the other?
Yeah, one definitely grew out of the other. The book even just came from, I spent a lot of time as a journalist traveling the country to different places, and I thought there had to be a way to use data to kind of understand the divides that you see as a journalist when you go to place. You notice similarities and differences between places. And, you know, what I did was I thought there should be a way to use data to break this down, and we broke down all the counties in America and the different types of place, 15 different types of place, and you know, lo and behold, when you do that, you see everything's different. We really are talking about not just, you know, different politics, you know, voting red or blue, but different economies, you know, different education levels. And it's really different cultural factors, different socioeconomic factors, and really different consumer lives. And when you put all those things together, what you have increasingly in this country is a split between the way urban America lives and big cities and kind of dense urban suburbs and even exurbs and the way rural America lives. They're really very different places.
I don't know that this would be possible to do, but if it would be possible to do, has anybody been able to go back in time to, say, 1960 or 1970 and use the same kind of information and put it through your whiz-bang computers and come up with a similar breakdown of what life was like then?
Frankly, that's something I'm very interested in doing, and the key to doing it is, you know, you get people moving and places growing and places changing, and you would see things look very different, because what's an urban place now, just from sprawl that's occurred around places, is really different. I mean, look at where you all are in Mecklenburg. I mean, the growth there, and in Wake County, has been astronomical. It's I mean, you guys know better than I do, but it's a radically different place than it was 10, 15, certainly 20
right.
years ago.
And that's why you don't like this. I'm not sure how this red state, blue state map came into being. I think it's a construction of television to make
yes.
things easy for viewers. But you don't like that map for this very reason. Is it simply too simplistic, or is it deceptive?
Well, I mean, I think that you – look, the red-blue map, we got to keep score, right? In the end, you have to have a scoreboard, and you find out who wins and who loses through the scoreboard, but – when you watch the game, you realize there's all these little things that made the score come out the way it did. So I'm fine with there being a red map and blue map for us to understand who won and who lost. My problem is when you get inside those maps, things look really different. So I grew up in Michigan. Michigan is a blue state, according to those red and blue maps, for quite a long time now. But, you know, the fact is that there are parts of Michigan that are very, very red. More of Michigan is red than blue, if you're talking about acreage. And, you know, for you guys in North Carolina, again, it's, you know, the reason why North Carolina is starting to change in this election in particular, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves here, is because there are more and more, regardless of what it looks like at the state level, at the small level, at the county level, the places that are blue are bigger than they were with more people than there used to be, and they could become much bluer. And so I think you need to get below that top level of let's look at states to get down and see what's going on underneath.
You've done this, Michael Bitzer. Mm-hmm. You have broken us down into little bitty pieces.
Well, Dante is exactly right. If you look at a map of North Carolina, the 100 counties, the vast majority of them look red. Mm-hmm. But those blue counties are critical in terms of the population and the votes that come out.
They would be Wake, Mecklenburg.
They would be Wake, Mecklenburg, Buncombe, Cumberland, you know, the Forsyth, Guilford counties, you know.
All the cities.
All the major cities in North Carolina. And if you take the 2012 election, out of the 100 counties, to get to 50% of the vote, you only needed 13 of them. 13 counties mm-hmm. out of 100 delivered 50% of the vote in 2012 and should also do it again this year. So the bulk come out of these major urban areas, the suburban counties, the Gastons, the Cabarrus, the Union counties. They also contribute as well. But Mecklenburg and Wake will contribute about 21% of all the votes. As well, just out of two counties, you'll get 20% of the vote. So
simply based on population.
Simply based on population and simply based on voters showing up. And that's and that has had a profound impact on North Carolina politics.
And I know this is anecdotal, but you told me a story just before we went on the air about running into a woman, talking to her about where you live because you teach it's in Salisbury, which is in Rowan County.
Right.
And she asked you where you lived.
And I said, I live here in Rowan County. And she said, well, where exactly? And I said, City of Salisbury. And she looked at me dead serious and said, Salisbury is not part of Rowan County. And it just took me back. I mean, this is a small city. It's about 35,000 residents. Everybody knows everybody. But the county and the city dynamics. Yeah. And I looked at the precincts, and City of Salisbury is deep, deep blue. The rest of the county, deep, deep red. And it's just like, wow, that played out for me and actually got my interest in this kind of urban-rural divide. And I moved there in 2002, and it's only gotten worse.
And that's exactly what has happened here with the great state of Mecklenburg, mm-hmm. As opposed to North Carolina. We really should secede.
Good luck with that. Have fun.
But this is what you're seeing all over the country, right, Dante?
Yeah, you can see it all over. And it's what's happened is, in my opinion, over the past 15, 20 years, the Republican Party has moved in a different sort of direction that has become much more heavily reliant on whites, rural whites in particular, blue-collar whites, and they've taken positions that kind of have alienated or pushed away, I don't know if it completely alienated, but for momentarily has pushed away college-educated whites, particularly in big, big urban places. You know, look, what's happened is we've sorted ourselves in a lot of ways, right? So we've decided certain types of people want to live in certain kinds of areas, and other types of people either can't move from where they are for economic reasons, or they've chosen to move away from those more urban locations. So what we have is places that are urban getting bigger, getting bluer, and it's happening all around the country. I will say it's a little exaggerated down in North Carolina. You guys even have more of this. Because you're getting blue people, as if we're going to use this kind of way of thinking of things. You're getting blue people from all around the country,
yeah.
Right? Because you're attracting people from other states, and you can actually track this using census data, using cross-county migration patterns, where people are coming from. And it's fascinating. When you look at, you know, Wake, Mecklenburg, Northern Virginia, right? And where are those people coming from? Well, they're coming from, you know, Madison, Wisconsin. They're coming from Boulder, Colorado. So you're getting lots of young college-educated people going here for jobs for the industries that are in those places.
Hmm. If you look at, to kind of back that up, if you look at the 6.8 million registered voters in North Carolina and those who indicated that they were born outside of North Carolina, 60% of them are living in an urban county in North Carolina, and they are having a tremendous impact on our politics and moving the state more and more towards this, to throw in one more color, purple status,
right,
of competitive battleground status.
So we're becoming more Smurfy because Smurfs are blue. because
thanks to the outsiders like me.
Because people from other parts of the country that were already blue are coming here. Is the reverse happening anywhere? Are people becoming redder in places that were formerly blue because of migration patterns?
Well, the one thing that's happening, it looks like, when you look at the map, is the the rural places that are red, and rural America is deep red in general. It is reliably red, and I think Trump could actually end up doing better in rural America than Mitt Romney did. They're growing redder in part because a lot of the blue people have left. Democrats, I hate to break this down to something very simple, but, you know, you have younger people, they leave their rural home to get a college education, and they don't come back.
Because? Do we know why?
Well, economics. Job opportunities are a big part of it.
Yeah.
It's not because their worldview has changed because of college?
Go ahead. No, please.
I would say that could have an impact, but certainly it is probably much more economically driven in terms of finding the jobs, the kind of lifestyle, particularly that millennials want to live. It's a very different scenario than how baby boomers and Gen Xers grew up. Millennials have a very distinct perspective, and that's been shown to be true. So they are naturally attracted to urban areas.
So migration patterns are changing the complexion of certain areas of the country in terms of being red or blue or purple. What else is going on? I mean, it seems to me that back in the day, there were three television networks. That's it. There wasn't Rush Limbaugh. There wasn't Fox News. There wasn't any cable news to speak of at all. We got our news in the newspaper, maybe talk radio in the morning or news radio in the morning and on television at night with Walter Cronkite and Chet Huntley and David Brinkley and, God, I'm a dinosaur.
Keep going. Keep aging yourself, please.
Peter Jennings. And now we have this 24-hour news cycle and we have the Twitterverse and Facebook and all this social media. How much of a role is that playing in all of this?
It's all reinforcement. It's basically you can go, as Dante talked about earlier, we are sorting ourselves into like-minded communities, and we only interact with like-minded people, and we get our news and reinforcement from like-minded institutions.
Even when there were just three networks, didn't we do the same thing?
The options weren't there.
Yeah.
So we would sort ourselves with people like ourselves when we went to church or we went to social gatherings, but we all gathered around the great hearth that was network television and had shared experiences. And now we gravitate toward things that reinforce, because they're available now, reinforce our preconceived notions. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't—
Bunkerizing or—
I don't think we—
Balkanizing?
I don't know how much I can go back in time to say the 1960s or the 1970s or the 80s was as sordid as we are now. I think this has been a gradual development over time. The parties have sorted themselves. Conservatives are very much in the Republican Party. Liberals are very much in the Democratic Party. We used to talk about these things called Southern Conservative Democrats.
Right.
We used to talk about Rockefeller Republicans, basically socially liberal. Those are gone. They are dead. They are extinct. We now have the parties sorted themselves, and we have sorted ourselves.
And that's the pain that particularly the Republican Party is experiencing this year?
Completely. I would contend that this is and for the Democrats, the canary in the coal mine, Bernie Sanders. And I think, you know, if Hillary Clinton gets elected, if she serves a term or two, Democrats are going to have to wrestle with a very much more liberal party, just as the conservatives are in the Republican Party.
Well, according to the American Communities Project, your organization, Dante, the country is remaking itself because of changes in technology and economics. And when we come back from the break, I want to ask, are we doing this or is it happening to us? Over which we have little or no control. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bragg Financial Advisors, supporting Catawba Lands Conservancy with 25 years of conservation at Taste of the Land, celebrating local farms and more. Dressler's Restaurant Charlotte on Thursday. Tickets and details at catawbalands.org/taste. Well, the rampant development that we've been experiencing in most parts of town has yet to reach the empty lot that was once Eastland Mall. It's been 3 years since the city demolished the old mall in hopes of priming the pump for revitalization. But so far, developers haven't taken the bait. But the city hasn't given up, and we check in to see what's going on, or not, and to find out what the city sees in the site that developers do not, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, early voting is underway in states across the country. And with less than 3 weeks to go before the presidential election, a look at the latest polls, the electoral map, and end-of-the-line strategies for both campaigns.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Dante Chinney, journalist in residence at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and the director of the American Communities Project. He has, for years now, kind of broken down residential and voting patterns into something far more complicated and intricate, which we'll talk about, than the red state-blue state divide we see on television. He's joining us by phone. Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College is with us in our studio. So according to the American Communities Project, of which you are the director, Dante, the country is remaking itself because of changes in technology and economics. So are we doing this? Are we aware that we're doing this? Or is it simply happening to us?
I think it's a bit of both, obviously. I do think we're not aware we're doing it. I don't think this is something we're trying to do. But mm-hmm. I think that when you talk about technology, one of the big changes that's happened, it's not just social media. And obviously social media is a big part of this because when you're saying about Facebook or Twitter, you construct the reality you want to live in. You know, you decide who your friends are, and sometimes people say things you don't like, and you unfriend them or whatnot. That's part of it. But, you know, the thing that's most fascinating to me is I'm old enough where I remember when the Internet first appeared, and there was all this talk about how geography wasn't going to matter anymore. It didn't matter. It didn't matter where you lived. You could live wherever you wanted to live and create a world for yourself on the Internet. You could be in rural Nebraska and be a serious New York Yankees fan if that's what you want to do, because you could just focus on everything involving the Yankees. Couldn't go see them, but everything else. But what's happened is the Internet has allowed us to create these worlds, and because we live near people that are like us, we're creating similar sorts of worlds. So, you know, there are a million different worlds you can live in on the Internet. But the fact is, if you live around people that are similar to you, you tend to occupy the same corners of the Internet. And your social media feeds tend to look fairly similar. And what you have is the Internet, which was supposed to break down these geographic barriers, has simply reinforced them. Yeah. And really allowed us. And this is not an indictment of the Internet. I'm not like, you know, so down with the Internet. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that this is the reality of what has happened, and this is the world we live in.
And perhaps we need a sociologist or a psychologist to tell us why. But why? It seems to me that prior to the Internet and prior to the 24-hour cable news universe that we live in and prior to social media, our window on the world, unless you were wealthy and well-traveled, was going to be either through books or movies or television. And those were little tiny glimpses through small little portals into a world that was usually fictional and not real. Now we have a window into the world that is never-ending. It's all-encompassing. It's anywhere we want to look at any time of the day or night. It's showing us the good, the bad, and the ugly. Why has this balkanized us? Are we afraid of it?
Boy, that's getting deep. I would have to say that part of it is the fact that nowadays technology allows us this opportunity to expand ourselves, but we feel most comfortable with things that we already know. And part of it is also the fact that anybody can put up anything on the Internet, but it doesn't really meet the truth factor,
but
whatever that is.
One of the things that we know about people, young people who go to college, is that in many cases, if they're paying attention, their worldview is expanded. They may not like everything that they see.
Right.
They may
education not does that.
They may not accept everything. They may reject some mm-hmm. things that they learn. But this is being on the Internet is kind of an education. You're seeing things that you probably didn't even know existed before.
Sure.
So why are we rejecting it and just going right down into the tiny little world that we want to live in because it's safe?
Well, I would say, you know, what you're talking about with college in particular, university education, is that's kind of a curated kind of exploration of the world, right?
Ah.
That's why you're there, really. You've got somebody kind of serving as your tour guide to the world. And eventually you leave college, and hopefully you retain some of this, you know, some of this kind of more exploratory view of the world where you want to go out and see things differently. But, you know, look, the fact of the matter is once you're out of school eventually, and you got your job, and you get a house and you get a family, you got a lot going on, and you're going to go to the places where you're comfortable. And I do think the real difference now compared to, say, 30 years ago is when you look, the viewership of the network news has collapsed, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Newspaper readership has collapsed. All these numbers have collapsed, and those are the places where the job was to kind of give an objective as much as it could be, standardized, like, I'm going to tell you what you need to know.
Except that more people still watch the evening newscasts on the three networks than watch all cable channels combined.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. So. Absolutely true.
So is it as simple as urban people seeing things one way and rural people seeing things another? And if so, why? What are the urban people seeing or experiencing that makes them different politically than the rural people?
Well, economically, I tend to think a lot of this has to do, it's cultural and it's it's socioeconomic, but there's a lot of economics here. Because look, even the things we're talking about, so these kids grow up, they leave their town, they go to college, and they don't come back, okay? So what does that mean? They go to places where there are other people who have college educations. And what's the nature of those places? The nature of those places is the economy is doing a lot better. So when you talk about kind of the aggrieved kind of tone,
is that because those people living in those areas are more educated, or simply because there is a critical mass of people available to do jobs, and therefore jobs locate there and not in rural areas?
It's it gets to the point where it's really hard to tell the difference between those two things. Because look, if you have there's all this talk about the private sector of the economy and how strong the private sector is, and the private sector is smarter than the public sector of how it spends its money. These are interesting debates to have. We can talk about them. But the one thing I can promise you is the private sector doesn't find a lot to like in rural America right now. That is not an educated workforce. Often the hubs of transportation are not very good. So where does the private sector congregate? It congregates around places where it has a skilled workforce, good transportation. Where are those places? They're urban places. What are those urban places filling up with? They're filling up with, people who vote Democratic for a variety of reasons across the country.
And I would throw in also the demographics, the diversity of urban areas versus rural areas, I think plays into this well. And I think for North Carolina, what we are seeing play out is one issue, and that is HB2. If you look at, where did that come out of? It came out of a major urban area. Where was the backlash? In rural counties. So rural legislators took on Charlotte in the state General Assembly. So that is, I think, the classic kind of division. When you have diversity in your community versus, for lack of a better term, non-diversity in rural areas, you're going to have that different worldview and perspective.
So would you say that the homogenous nature of rural America is what's at the root of all this more than anything else? The fact that everybody there is like everybody there. They go to the same churches. They experience life in the same way. They're facing the same economy. They talk to people every day just like themselves.
I think it's true in rural and urban counties.
Okay.
I think we have done it to ourselves. And we are to blame for that. And when we figure out that we can't talk to somebody from a different area and a different political party because we don't know where they're coming from, that is the collapse of how I see our civic participation and opportunities to engage in civic constructive dialogues without yelling at each other and calling each other names.
Well, given what Dante Cheney has done with the red state, blue state map, I don't see any hope here.
I'm with you. I'm at a loss as to how we break this.
Because let's talk about this. When you look at the map that the American Communities Project has put together, and I'm assuming that this is online someplace where people can see it, because I have been able to see it, and it's interactive. You can actually
AmericanCommunities.org.
Okay, you can actually hover your mouse over every single county in America, mm-hmm. and see information about them. And you put together this map that is green and yellow and orange and red and blue and black, and they don't. When you overlay all of that over the red state, blue state map, it doesn't coincide.
Well, I would say that, all right, if you look at North Carolina and the counties that are labeled evangelical hubs, mm-hmm. which is kind of west of us, kind of leading up into the mountains area, that is deep red Republican in North Carolina politics. That's kind of the heart, the traditional heart of the Republican Party oftentimes. And so that, I think, plays out and correlates well. If you look at Mecklenburg, if you look at Wake County that are described as big city counties, those are Democratic more and more counties. And I think you're seeing that kind of play out.
So we have put this map on our website, too. I'm not sure it's interactive on our website, but maybe it is. Who knows? It is. Okay. So this your map, Dante, has 15 county types created by using – correct me if I'm wrong, because I read this very quickly yesterday.
Sure.
15 county types created by using 36 different indicators, resulting in 13 groupings. And if I understand this correctly, you can have very different types side by side.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely true.
Okay,
yeah.
The county types are African American South, aging farmlands, big cities, college towns, evangelical hubs, exurbs, graying America, Hispanic centers, LDS enclaves, that's the Mormon Church, Latter-day Saints, middle suburbs, military posts, Native American lands, rural middle America, urban suburbs, and working class country. That is a lot of categories, some of which I would think would have some overlap. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so for the election, I tried to find a way. So I work with NBC and the Wall Street Journal. I get their polling data, and you can break down the polling data in a lot of interesting ways, but if you get a sample of, say, 1,000 people and they do a survey, you can't break it into 15 types. So I merged some of these together and wound up with 7. So you get a lot of crossover between, say, like rural middle America and working class country. You know, working class country it's a bit like the evangelical hubs, but doesn't have a lot of the religious overlay. It's more just kind of working class, blue collar. And you do see similarities there, and you see some of the things that are interesting when you look at the country this way is you talk about the African American South, and a lot of those counties, politically speaking, vote Republican. And people say, "Well, how can that be?" Well, the reason that is if you have a large African American population, even if it's 40% of the county, you know, you're still talking that 60% that's not African American, and 40% is a huge number. By U.S. standards, the average is somewhere around 13% for the U.S. population. So those places can still be very Republican, right? So even if it has a large African American population, those places can be split, and they're really fascinating. Those African American South communities, the vote is really divided. Like you look at it and you're like, well, white people here are voting one way and black people are voting another, and that's mm-hmm. just what happens in those places. But why we did 15 was look, I wanted this to be as subtle and nuanced as possible. I know it's hard for the media sometimes, and as a member of the media, I understand that. But for me, it really helps me to see the map that I have at AmericanCommunities.org, that when something's happening politically, it's the map I go to, and it doesn't tell me everything about a place, because I don't know every county in America, thank God. And I mouse over the place, and I say, "Oh, okay, all right, that makes sense. All right, now let me do a little more research into that place and see what's going on." But I will say, not to just toot my own horn, because I worked with a very good grad student at Stanford to build this thing. It's remarkably useful, especially for this election in particular, where the urban-rural divide is so stark. It tells you a lot.
I use this in my state and local politics class, and the students are fascinated by the different categories, but it can help them to see trends mm-hmm. and patterns. And we start talking about locations, and we start talking about how things are different from one area to the other. It really is a great resource for folks to see.
Well, I color code when I wrote these on my list. I color coded them according to what I thought would be red, blue, or purple, and the predominant is red. Would that be right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, that's true with any map of the election. Mostly red.
So that in that case, it does correspond to the big TV maps. The biggest groupings of counties are the big cities, urban suburbs, and the exurbs. They have a different outlook, if I understand this correctly, than people living in more rural areas. By population, The big city counties have nearly 74 million people. The urban suburbs, 66.5 million people. The exurbs, 32 million people. That's around 172 million people. When you add up the rest, though, you come up with 134 million, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. That would give big cities the advantage here when you bring in some of the other groups like African Americans and graying Americans. Even some military people also live in places like urban suburbs, mm-hmm. exurbs, yep. and big cities. So when you bring in these people like graying Americans who are probably more conservative mm-hmm. and military people who are probably more conservative and you put yeah. them in an exurb or a suburb, urban suburb, or you put them in a big city, does that change the influence of those areas? Does it add or detract the progressive nature of those areas?
I mean, there are definitely differences between different big cities. If you were to look at, like, politically what Philadelphia looks like, which is a very dense, small, big city, compared to, say, Wake or Mecklenburg, I mean, Philadelphia is remarkably Democratic. I mean, or Washington, D.C., for that matter, where where your vote is almost irrelevant in a presidential race because the Democrat's going to get 80%. Yeah. There's definitely some difference depending on the kind of population in those places. So if you had, say, a big city with a lot of military folks in it, it would probably lean a little more to the center or a little more to the right. But, you know, the thing is, when you get to those really big, big city counties, they're so big and so diverse that, you know, you throw in 10,000 people, it doesn't change things very much.
And I think I was just going to say, here in North Carolina, I think the other thing that we have to talk about is the polarization going on. I mean, if you look at some of these elections in precincts within these counties, there are precincts that will vote 60% or more for one party. You generally tend to find that in either urban areas for Democrats or rural areas for Republicans. If you take all 2,800 precincts in North Carolina, 15% will be competitive between 45 and 55. That means we are basically moving into areas, and those areas are becoming more and more non-competitive, and it's just kind of reinforcing itself.
This is completely anecdotal, and I haven't done that much driving around the area, but when I have driven, I'm not seeing a lot of yard signs this year, particularly for presidential candidates. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing some for the down ballot races, mm-hmm. but not necessarily. Maybe it's because people don't want to put a Clinton or a Trump sign because they don't want
that
their house firebombed.
That could be that as well. Exactly. on both sides.
But if you cross the Catawba River, I'm told, and you go into Gaston mm-hmm. County, there are hordes of – this is anecdotal – there are hordes of Trump signs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, Gaston, Iredell, Union, Catawba, York, Mecklenburg, they're all part of the Charlotte region, so to speak. So we qualify as a big cities county, Mecklenburg. Doesn't the region qualify as a big city region? And if that's true, don't we cancel each other out, the Democrats and Republicans?
Not necessarily. I mean, in urban counties in North Carolina, they're going to vote 56% Democratic. In suburban counties, the outlying counties around major areas, they're actually going to vote more Republican, 62%, than rural counties, which are 57% Republican. Mm. So there is a very distinct difference. You go to Gaston, Cabarrus, you're in a very different world.
This year, Dante Cheney says it's all about the exurbs. That's a new word for me, so we'll find out exactly what that means when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and TRCW, a specialty shop for men built and headquartered in Charlotte, featuring European and American tailored clothing and accessories in Phillips Place. Details at trcstyle.com. Early voting is underway in states across the country, just over 2 weeks, 15 days, before the presidential election. A look at the latest polls, the electoral map, and end-of-the-year strategies for both campaigns. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes. It's at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it. Now's the time. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Thank you to the nearly 4,000 listeners who became WFAE members during our fall membership campaign. I'm General Manager Joe O'Connor. Your tax-deductible donations go directly into the highest quality programming that you expect from your NPR news station. If you didn't get a chance to give, you can do so right now at WFAE.org. Thanks again for supporting WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about beyond red and blue states to the urban-rural divide that we're experiencing, and something new, a very colorful map that the American Communities Project has put together. You can find it on their website at AmericanCommunitiesProject.org or on our website at WFAE.org. Dante Chinney is with us. He's the journalist in residence at George Washington University and the director of the American Communities Project. Dr. Michael Bitzer is also here from Catawba College. Before I ask you about the excerpts, John in Charlotte posted this on, I guess, Facebook or Twitter. No, I guess it's Facebook. Or maybe it's an email. Who knows? Who cares? He says, I find I find the broad generalizations to be somewhat disturbing. I've lived in Charlotte for 20 years and moved from a blue state, but have been and continue to be a conservative Republican. Many of my friends moved in from out of state and are also Republicans. You would paint a picture of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County as a liberal bastion. I strongly disagree. Depends on where you live in the
county.
It depends.
I dare say I'm going to make a prediction, which I'm loath to do this year, but I'm going to predict that perhaps this gentleman lives in the southern wedge of Charlotte.
That would
which
be Ballantyne.
Ballantyne, mm-hmm. Myers Park, South Park. Very Republican, although it is starting to transition into some competitive precincts. But if you look at a map of Mecklenburg, there is, and break it down by precincts, deep, deep blue inside Charlotte, with the exception of the Southern Wedge. And there people are reinforcing themselves with like-minded folks, and they only talk to Republicans. That's the point that I'm making, is that we are in these areas that could be very isolated. And if you look at voter registration in Mecklenburg County, Republicans are third. So there is a dwindling of Republicans in this county.
Who's first? Independents?
Democrats.
Okay.
And unaffiliateds have gone and have overtaken registered Republicans in Mecklenburg. And it's mostly due to millennials, younger voters. But this is the trend that Mecklenburg is going through.
Okay. So, Dante, you say that this presidential election year, it's all about the exurbs. What are the exurbs? Where are they?
Actually, you've got a few down there. Just really, really quickly, so I'll get on that. But Mecklenburg, because I get this complaint a lot, like, that's not my experience. And my answer is that I understand there are outliers everywhere. But Mecklenburg County, for instance, Barack Obama won 61% of the county. That's a very high margin. And I understand that maybe the gentleman who posted doesn't feel that applies to him, and I'm sure it doesn't. But, you know, as it's an apocryphal quote, but Pauline Kael, after in 1972, when Nixon won, she was the film critic for The New Yorker, and she said, I don't know how Nixon won. Nobody I know voted for him. And, you know, it's like, that's right. But, you know, as for exurbs, exurbs are, if you look at the vote generally coming out of the last four presidential elections, that's where the vote switches from being Democratic to being Republican. So, for instance, Barack Obama won urban suburbs by 16 points. Mitt Romney won the exurbs by 18 points. So what are they? They tend to be less diverse, more white, non-Hispanic population. They're less dense, so they're not as densely populated. They're more of a sprawly kind of area. But they are full. This is really the core of what's left of the educated kind of Republican, wealthy Republican base. These are a lot of people with money in the stock market. These are a lot of people who've done, you know, this is for the county as a whole. These places tend to be better educated, wealthier, and, you know, there are, in some ways, if you want to think about it this year, particularly the way the election's shaken out, if we're talking about winners and losers in the economy, the exurbs are full of winners. They're people who have done pretty well. They're just less diverse and definitely less
and
diverse.
Rural counties are the losers.
So bring it home.
They are.
What would be our exurbs in this region?
Well, if you look at the map that that Dante's got, he's basically looking at Union County, Cabarrus, Lincoln County, Iredale, all around the central kind of core of Mecklenburg. And that's our region.
And if you say it's all about them, what does that mean? They're going to control the outcome of the election? Is that what you're saying? Their decision?
What I'm saying is that these places should be, this is the place where the vote pivots, like I said. This is where it goes from being Democratic to being Republican in most cases, and strongly Republican. But the problem is, in 2016, that Donald Trump's rhetoric and his message is not a very good fit in a lot of ways for these people. These are not people who want to hear about how horrible the economy is and how we need to do something about trade deals.
Because for them, it's not bad.
Right.
That's right. Absolutely. Exactly.
And they've benefited from these trade
deals
through the stock market and investments.
Yep. But if you go into a rural county and go to a former textile mill county, you will find very strong Trump support. Yeah. You will also find lower education in those counties and higher support for Trump, which is what I found in the March primary here in North Carolina.
There's a lot of anger and frustration, and the anger and frustration out there is being driven partially by the economy and by changes that people are fearing as society changes. But a lot of it's the economy and jobs and things like that. How much of it is, as Donald Trump beats the drum successfully with these people about bad trade deals and immigration, hordes of immigrants coming across the border taking American jobs, how much of it is because these people who are angry about this voted in people who voted for NAFTA, telling them it was going to be good for them and it wasn't? Telling them that the costs of goods and services would decline, which has happened. But you can't have it both ways. The reason towels are cheap is because they're made overseas.
Right.
How much of that anger is from the fact that they feel duped by having done what they've done before, voting for these people who have done these things to them?
I think – go ahead, Don.
Go ahead. No, I'm going to let you take that.
That's because it's a thanks. Stupid question.
No, I think, you know, if you want to make the what's wrong with Kansas argument, I think that's what it is. I think people vote against their own self-interest, you know, for other reasons. I think the level of anger against the establishment, no matter how you define that, whether it's politicians long serving or you know, the system is rigged, I think that is tapping into something. But the question is, how do you then resolve it without making the situation even worse?
The anger and frustration, is it primarily economic, or is it also about the changing complexion of the country and about the changing roles of men and women in society and in the workplace?
I would argue that it is about the societal changes, the demographic changes. Whites in particular are becoming less and less a majority.
But it's like a tsunami. You can't stop it. Why be angry?
Demographics
about it?
Are destiny, I mean, know, for a lot of us.
As Hillary said, anger is not a plan.
But you always get this backlash when society goes through an evolutionary change. Think about going from the farms to the factories in the late 1800s. There was a huge backlash
against
that. But
didn't we learn from that?
Why? We did.
Wouldn't you be better off embracing the inevitable and kind of trying to find a way to come to terms with it?
You mean you like change?
No, I don't like change.
Well, then you just answered your own question.
Yes, but if you know that it... If you know that it's coming and it can't be stopped, wouldn't it be in your best interest to find a way to embrace it and deal with it and make a profit out of it?
Well, look, in a lot of these places, look, because of what we're talking about, the way people live their lives, you know, they're seeing things. If you live in a rural county where you're talking, some of these counties, you're talking well over 80% of the population is non-Hispanic white, right? You're talking about, you could be talking 90, 95% in some places, okay? Different places. Look, the reality that the world they're seeing on television does not comport to their everyday reality. And they're like, I don't want to be part of that. I don't want to be part of that world. That's not the world I want to live in. Hmm. And, you know, I will be the first to say, when it comes to the economic stuff, that, you know, some Trump supporters have a point. And that, look, they have been left behind. They have. And things are really hard for them. And I understand the anger. Whether or not what he's proposing are answers to their problems, that's a whole different question. But, you know, they don't. The world is not working for them economically. They turn on the television and they see a world that they really don't like, that they don't want to be a part of. And it is what you're talking about, is that to have them change their point of view to, in such a way to say, like, you know what, you know, I can't beat them, so I'm going to join them. That's tough. That's a really tough argument.
And you point out that people still believe in America, but because of our divisions, it's very difficult to get things done, and that we are in for a bumpy decade, 10 more years of this. If I get you right, the problems we face and the reasons for the frustration and anger are not really the result of Democratic or Republican policies or politicians, but that the economy has fundamentally changed despite them, and neither side knows what to do about it.
I think that's true. I'm not Mr. Sunshine, obviously, but you know, I look at the problems we face right now as a country, and they are really complicated. There aren't easy answers anymore, and a bumpy decade. You know, I wrote that in 2010. You know, you can at least add a decade onto that now.
Wow.
Right? I mean, I do think politically things are going to get very bumpy, very bumpy. But economically, it's been bumpy. It's going to stay bumpy.
Well, when you say very bumpy, I mean, could this be the all empires decline? Could this be the beginning of the end because we simply can't talk to each other? Or could this be like the beginnings of the Civil War again?
Well, it wouldn't be. You know, the Civil War analogy is really interesting because it would be, instead of being North versus South, it would be within states.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's what's so interesting about it. So it's never going to happen like that again, because even like the regional idea of America, I think, doesn't work as well anymore. I mean, like, there are some regional differences, but like, there are the real divide is this divide we're talking about. It's about urban areas and big, dense urban suburbs and kind of everybody else. And that's in almost every state around the country, within the state.
I think I'm reading a book called Hillbilly Elegy, and it's a memoir by somebody who goes back to his Rust Belt home. Mm. And it is just a fascinating study of what people are confronted with in rural America that people in urban America do not understand don't see. The issue of meth and the issues of poverty and the issues of not having jobs and just the societal breakdown that's occurring in rural America. And there is a level of resentment that they see the big cities getting everything, and they're prospering, and they have been left behind. And that, I think, is the real cause. Until politicians, no matter from what party, no matter from what perspective, deal with that divide, I don't see how we get through this.
Well, you say, Dante, and I know that the previous quote that I made, that I took from you, came from 10 years ago, and now you're expanding on it and saying it's going to be 10 more years beyond the time you wrote that quote. You also say you don't think things are going to fall apart, but that it's going to take things getting really bad before people will put aside some of their differences and have to say, okay, I may not agree with you, but we all have to come to the table and try to figure some stuff out here. That sounds like a little bit like when an addict has to hit rock bottom before they can turn things around. Will it take us hitting rock bottom to sit down at the table, be willing to sit down at the table and talk things out?
It may. I mean, I
what does that look like? What is rock bottom?
Well, I think the one thing that may help us as a country is I think it's a really good point. The Democrats have to go through this kind of remaking of the party, and the Republicans are definitely just starting on the path now. That kind of has to sort itself out first. And I really wonder what the two political parties look like in, say, 2024.
Mm.
And then I think, because we're going through, everybody talks about realignments and, you know, it gets a little silly at times, but we really are going through one right now. And we kind of need to have an understanding of what the new political dynamic is before I think we can have that discussion. That's why I think it's going to be extremely bumpy while we're just sorting through the kind of the political mess. And then maybe when we have an idea of what the parties are and what they stand for and what they're pushing for, then we can sit down and have that conversation. But we're just not there yet.
Well, if we don't have the Yellow Dog Democrats or the Blue Dog Democrats, whatever color they used to be, we don't have those people anymore. We don't have these Rockefeller Republicans anymore. And Donald Trump has fairly well redefined what Republican means. I mean, some of these, like Paul Ryan hasn't backed away from his endorsement. But the Republican Party as represented by Donald Trump is not the Republican Party as represented by Paul Ryan.
No.
Are we seeing the collapse of that party? Will we see a different party emerge from the ashes of this election, whether he wins or loses?
I think in 2 weeks we will have to start to see a real conversation within the Republican Party, figuring out what exactly it is and where it gets its base of support, because the two sides, the establishment, the Paul Ryan wing, and the Trumpites led by Donald Trump, just cannot get along with each other. I think you're seeing the recriminations, and it will play out November 8th as well.
So given what you know, Dante, about the various colors of the map, not red and blue, but all these other colors and how it shakes out, should we believe the polls that say Hillary's way ahead, or should we believe that maybe some people are not telling the truth when they talk to pollsters, and on Election Day we're going to be very, very surprised?
Well, this year I don't want to predict anything anymore. I'm out of the prediction business, but I would say that, look, when the lead gets to what it is right now in the polls, when you start talking about a 6, 7, 8 point lead, you know, nationally, that's a pretty big lead, and that's probably real, and it's pretty consistent across different polling companies now, aside from a few before everybody tweets, aside from a few outliers, that 6 to 8 to 10 points, that's where it is. It's hard to imagine the numbers throwing that off, and there is not, you know, kind of this hidden kind of Trump army that exists out there throwing that off. There is not evidence that the hidden Trump army has mobilized yet. Mm. Could we all be surprised? Yeah. I mean, will we all be surprised? I doubt it. But, hey, we don't know.
This would be a great time to ask you what needs to happen, or if you had any suggestions for getting together at the table to talk things out, to find common ground on which we can begin a conversation. But alas, we are out of time. That is a show for another day. Dante Cheney, director of the American Communities Project, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science at Catawba College. AmericanCommunitiesProject.org to see the map. Thank you all for the